Well, welcome back after a joyous and enjoyable reading week, hopefully, in which you're doing whatever you're doing reading week. Reading, presumably. Anyway, it's all going, visiting, home, whatever. Couple of things to start off with, because we're slightly low in numbers due to illness and various other bits and pieces today. We'll be recording the lecture today, as was the case with respect to the function of the political journalist and political communications, which I'll put a hyperlink to this on the website, but it is, as I say, there under political communications in the public sphere. So that'll be the first 45, 50 minutes, and then hopefully we'll have a look at maybe three or four of you doing presentations about the sort of topics. Yes, Rebecca?
I just wanted to let you know that I didn't prepare this lesson.
That's okay. That'll be, well, then there'll be four or three or two. It's no worries. That's okay. As I say, the only real reason to go through the process is I want to get a flavour for what sort of things you're actually doing and get some initial feedback, etc. But I think the bulk of them will be taking place next week, and who knows, maybe even the week after. So there's no major sort of crisis from that point of view. Anyway, welcome George, welcome Dorothy. Really grand sort of scenario, and just pointing out that the political communications thing is actually up and online. I will put a hyperlink to that on the Blackboard website, and we'll do the same pretty much with the session today, which, for the first section at least, is the wonderful world of something else which is at the heart of the public sphere, and we're really going to be looking at the interface between between public relations as an industry, as a profession and so on, and also political reporters, which in itself is another one of those public spheres that is at the heart of this particular module, because there is clearly an interrelationship between what parliamentary parties and government bodies want to be released to the public domain. And then there's material they don't want to be necessarily released in the public domain. Now, you might sort of say, what, really? Yes, it may be because it's in the public interest not to release material. It may well be because it's a case of different strategies are being put together. There are a whole range of reasons why. And obviously this is one of the challenges that if you're working not just for national government, but also for local government as well, you can be faced with this whole challenge of how do you operate between the political reporters on the one hand, and indeed the politicians on the other. So, to start off with this, consider the views of this particular number in terms of what Alistair Campbell,
the world's worst kept,
formerly, of course, spin doctor / communications officer for Tony Blair, etc., made of the fictitious character Malcolm Tucker, played by Peter Capaldi, in the series The Thick of It. Has anybody not seen The Thick of It here? One or two. Well, have a look on YouTube. You might find it mildly amusing and relaxed as well. The Thick of It basically was a spoof series about the inner workings of Westminster, featuring Peter Capaldi as a character called Malcolm Tucker, who effectively was a fairly robust person who had a whole range of sort of views which were, you might say, employed bullying, employed a whole range of things. He did for political PR spin doctors what Alan Partridge does for show presenters on the BBC. And again, any Alan Partridge souls here might want to check out the 9:30, or indeed via iPlayer. Any Alan Partridge people here who sort of see the joys of that? Yes, good, okay. Have a glass of water, please. Sorry, it's a reference there. You get it, Dorothy, hopefully. Anyway, it's how Campbell, as the serious person, the sort of target spoof, related to his particular thing in this short interview with Mark Commode.
The secret was that this comic creation was based on Tony Blair's top spin doctor, Alistair Campbell. Campbell was famously furious with the BBC when they implicated him in the dodgy dossier row in the run-up to the war with Iraq. Till the BBC acknowledged that is a lie, I will keep going on. So how will he feel now that BBC Films have reprised Tucker for Amanda Iannucci's feature debut In the Loop, complete with demented tirades, lies and spin leading to war in the Middle East?
Yeah, okay. good homework. We'll see you. Welcome to the culture.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Yes. No better way to find out than to watch the film with the man himself.
And so if we can tackle the easy things like diarrhea, then we can...
I'll say it again. Yes, very good. What is this, the shitting forecast?
From the very beginning, Tucker is at his brutal best, enraged by a series of disastrous media appearances by Cabinet Minister.
Now points to a US military intervention in the Middle East. Is that your view?
Well, personally, I think that war is unforeseeable.
Sam! Sam!
Unforeseeable? Yes.
No, you do not think that!
That's my thing.
But as he tries to manage the fallout, Tucker finds himself out of his depth as he pushes the special relationship towards war in the corridors of Westminster, the White House, and the UN, or at least I thought so.
So, Alistair, I get the feeling that I laughed more than you did. What did you think?
I found it a lot less funny than I thought it was going to.
Yeah?
Yeah. I think, I've seen a few of the episodes of The Thick of It, and some of them are funny. I didn't find that terribly funny. I think it was like, it's like the difference between a really good cartoon and a really good painting. It was a cartoon.
No, there was one line I really, really liked where the guy said, I'm not going to read you the write-up, but I am going to read extras. I don't know why, but I really liked that as a piece of one-line writing. I liked that. And there were a few like that, there were.
There was a lot like that.
No, there were a few like that. I thought it was both most real and funniest when it kind of stepped a little bit out of the politics, and it was Toby and his relationships.
What you picked out as the bits that you enjoyed were the bits that actually have nothing to do with the political stuff and that you're kind of out of, the bits that they would presumably say, well, of course he's able to enjoy those bits because those aren't the bits in which we're having a go at him and his legacy.
You're assuming that I watch that and see it like this is kind of a portrayal of the government in which I worked, and I don't really.
No, I don't.
It's like watching a very, very long cartoon. And the best cartoons are quite short.
Do you think there's any sense that you might not have found some bit funny because you found it uncomfortable?
No, I don't find it uncomfortable. I mean, I think if you're going to do a film like that, there's got to be something in there that you can say, well, actually, yeah, that might have happened.
Yeah.
And there's very little in there where you can say that might have happened. I mean, just to give you a few examples. I mean, the Tucker and all the swearing and the rest of it. Look, I can swear as well as anybody,
okay. Right?
And I do swear a lot, but you're not going to go into the White House and start going up to complete strangers and effing and bloody and all the rest of it.
Is this it? No offence, son, but I knew about you should still be at school. Your head down a fucking toilet.
Your first point there, the offence, I'm afraid I'm going to have to take it. Your second point, I'm 22, but it's my birthday in 9 days, so... make you feel more comfortable, we can wait.
Do you see yourself or people you know in those characters?
No, not really, no. I mean, I see... If you do I see in somebody like Tucker somebody who's got the same kind of drive and determination that I had to try to get things organised the way you want to organise them? Yes.
Okay.
But... beyond that, what there isn't in any of those characters is a kind of belief system. In my experience, most people who go into it, they kind of believe something. They have a strong set of beliefs that takes them in the first place. Do they have to manage the media? Yes, they do. Do they have sometimes bad days when the minister's not on form? Yes, they do. But are they all a bunch of venal, self-serving, unprincipled shit? No, they're not.
Mr. Ambassador, with your big baldy hair, you are spoiling us.
Excuse me, just a second. Huh? I'm pleased to be able to tell you that by some huge personal effort on my behalf, I've managed to bring your vote forward by an hour and a half. Did we say thank you?
Great, well, I ain't it delayed now.
Very funny.
Yeah, by an hour at least. Well, I mean, actually, well, 2.5 hours now that you've brought it forward.
No, I will not put myself through that humiliation again. I'm just not doing it.
Right. How do you feel about the fact that the character, which is, you know, a cipher of you in that film, effectively leads the country into what appears to be an unjust war?
You know, it's... if you want to talk about the war, we can talk about the war.
No, I want to talk about the film's portrayal of the war, because I do think, in the way it's portrayed in the film, it's utterly flippant.
You're asking me, in a way, to take it more seriously than I think I should. Because,
yes, I am. Yeah.
Right, well, but I don't take it that seriously. That film is trying to portray a very narrow, in my view, pretty lazy view of politics, and it doesn't do it as well as it didn't think of it.
Currently, more.
I have a great sympathy for anything which portrays politics as essentially venal and crass, because I think that to a great extent, it is.
Yeah.
And I think that that's your legacy, which is why I want to know whether or not it upsets you to think that that would be taken as your legacy.
No, it upsets me to think that somebody who seems to be quite an intelligent bloke like you would think that politics is venal and crass, when I could sit down and explain to you how politics has delivered most of the great things that have happened in the world in its history. And if people like you just go around the place as you do, spreading that message that politics is venal, politics is crass, the only people who are really great, the kind of creators who go to the arts and make movies and all this, and carry on spreading that worldview, then don't be surprised if young people then start to say, well, you know, why should we give a shit about the world? And I actually think that you guys, with the attitudes you have to face up sometimes to your own responsibilities about the impact that has upon the way that the world works. So scepticism is great, but what you just expressed to me is cynicism.
But do you?
And you know, it's just so lazy, it's so easy, and you should know better.
But do you understand why it would be that somebody would get that impression of British politics?
Only if they consumed, totally believed, and took as their total consumption of British politics what they get from sections of the British media. The media is obsessed with itself. They are never happy that we're talking about themselves. They are never happier than when standing outside Downing Street said, I've just been at a briefing and I was told this, and da-da-da, because they're talking about themselves. It doesn't matter that much. And so, and when you sort of say that, you point to the screen and say, that's your legacy, it's more complicated than that.
In here, you can influence things, you can delay things. Out there, you're just going to be another fucking mouthy, fucking shouty mad fucker that people don't want to make eye contact with. Remember Mary? Remember what happened to her? She took a stand on health. Everybody decided that she was mental.
Because the Sun showed a picture of her with wide eyes and her head on a cow.
Yeah, well, I happened to find that was a particularly powerful image.
There's a heroic vulgarity in the speech, which I think is funny. I mean, I think it's not. I mean,
fuck, 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 fuck.
But it's not just fuck, 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 fuck. It's, you know, fuckety by, and it's, you know, it's inventive swearing. Does that bear any relationship to the way in which you would talk in meetings or colleagues around you would talk?
No. Look, I probably swear more than most.
Do you?
Yeah, but I wouldn't swear. Did I ever swear in front of George Bush?
Okay, but not with the Americans. When you were there, you know, on your home territory, would you storm around swearing like that?
Not like that, no.
What was the worst swearing you ever did when you were working?
I did used to say fuck the fuck off.
Fuck it, Malcolm. It's Malcolm for me too. How does it do that?
Simon, I don't like finding out about people employed by this government via the news unless they just died.
Have you ever had two phones at the same time?
Yes.
So that is true.
Oh yeah, but you probably have.
No.
Has anybody here actually had two phones at the same time? I see, that's something to graduate to, isn't it? Point about this being, not only does it kind of resonate with that wonderful I word, indeterminacy, because he moves from actually something which is quite a heartfelt statement, where he says, if people just get all the material information from mass media and the art forms and so on, they come away with a very jaded, very jaundiced, very cynical view of politics. To the extent that actually, just a few minutes later, he's saying, well, actually, yes, I might have said F, I've used the F word here, the F word there, and so on. And it's an interesting sort of take in terms of, again, it's discourse, it's discussion. As far as Habermas would say, there it is. Where do you actually find that whole truth within that whole sequence? As we'll see her say in a few moments, when we come on to another example. So let's look at what it really should function like, what in the British Constitution, which actually is an unwritten constitution, because we don't actually have anything written down, unlike the American Constitution. Various people over the years have tried to get something written down to explain what Britain's all about, but actually it runs by convention with Her Majesty the Queen is the head of state, who again doesn't take any active part in the governance, but at the same time is still part of the establishment that runs the country and so on. And in terms of that relationship between the press, the media, the public relations people and so on, you will pretty much find that you've got around about, usually it's about 170 accredited journalists who effectively be part of what's referred to as the lobby. The people that in that little interview Campbell's referring to as the folk who actually say, I've just been at a briefing with so-and-so government minister, this is what they've said, and so on and so forth. Tactically, sometimes material is leaked just to see how it's responded to. Oftentimes you'll get a government who will say, well, let's say that we're putting up rail prices by 400% and see what the response is. They might have an idea. Nobody actually says anything. They might say, great, maybe we can actually try this and so on. Maybe it's a way of actually floating that idea about how you can actually relate to various other bits and pieces. And until actually the 1990s and John Major decided to actually make these briefings public, all of this would actually be happening anonymously. It's one of the reasons why reports such as the Chalacock Commission, the Leveson Report and so on, the press, you know, there is this cozy relationship between journalists, parliamentarians, the press officers and so on, all of which would be subsumed under the underlying title Downing Street Sources and so on. And interestingly enough, again, gender politics notwithstanding, Alistair Campbell himself under Tony Blair was very much the Prime Minister's spokesman. The person who's effectively given that brief to actually work through issues and lines and so on. There's an acronym that probably you weren't expected to see today, SPADs, but effectively those are special advisors that can actually be taken from all strata of society. If you're doing an investigation into genetic foods, for instance, you might want to have somebody who would be coming to it with a background in science and nutrition and so on and so forth. But there's certainly a tension between, on the one hand, the government, who clearly are political, because that's what we vote, either Conservative, Liberal, Labour, Green, whatever your kind of particular flavour happens to be, voting for the party and so on, or, again in the public sphere, the civil service, who are traditionally supposed to be completely neutral or apolitical. They're not meant to actually have any connection from that. And just to give you an example in terms of how you can actually drive a horse and cart through some of those areas, let's have a look at another example of satire.
Just to keep you up to speed, Terry, we are going to do a companion launch for Digital Playgrounds tonight at the Learning Centre at 7 o'clock. All right, and we just need you to pop a press pack in the Curry microwave and let us know what you think.
Yes, I know. I don't think I'll be able to get that clear before 6, so that's effectively tomorrow, isn't it?
Sorry, Terry, we don't need clearance. We're not covering a Beatles track with a fucking government.
Yes, I'm sorry, but I do need to get that through number 10 before I can do anything.
Was Terry actually in the meeting earlier, Adam?
Yes, she was, Fergus. I know she was there because I heard her humming the theme tune to call the midwife.
Yes, well, Stuart was very clear about this protocol. It's about the only thing he ever has been clear about.
So the policy has been agreed. This is just an additional publicity push.
Adam, I'm sorry if you think I'm being obstructive, but I cannot and I will not do as you ask.
Well, you can't stop me, Terry, okay? I want you to know, you cannot win, Nurse Ratchet, because this is my moment.
Now, you like musicals. Well, this is Tonight from West Side Story, yeah? And I'm going to bring the bloody house down so you can't rain on my parade, funny girl. Why ain't you going to have a lie down and a hobnob while we run the fucking country, all right?
Anything else?
I think so.
Thank you, Minister.
Sometimes there's more that you can actually get from satire, as Jonathan Swift kind of identified, than any other areas from that point of view. There we had a situation whereby, obviously, you had the press officer, the government, challenge between the two, how do you actually relate to these things, and probably something which is not too dissimilar to the kind of things Theresa May is having with her Brexit challenges and so on. So the question that we can put to yourselves in terms of a public sphere line of things there is that practical? I mean, we know that the civil service should be impartial. They shouldn't actually have any view on a situation. Their job is quite simply to implement the decisions made by the ruling parliamentary body, the government at the time. And there's the other question, of course, which says, shouldn't you actually have the civil servants be impartial? What if we're trying to push through lines which are deemed to be wrong or challenging, morally questionable, and so on? Again, I'm not going to draw the obvious connections between the ongoing negotiations and so on and so forth with Brexit and more, but clearly that's at the heart of some of the issues that we're talking about here. Paul Staines, who's known by his alter ego Guido Fox, actually referred to the press lobby, that group of accredited press people, as a cartel. Cartel basically means a monopoly that's set up without any legal sanctions that effectively controls everything. It's an unelected body that's actually there from that point of view. And why do you think that current system of accreditation and access is unhealthy? I mean, it is actually easier to get a press pass for the White House in the United States of America to attend one of Donald Trump's sessions than it is to get one for Westminster. Is that good? Or does that perpetuate the kind of challenges that we've got here in terms of an open society? Dorothy, what do you think?
I think if you can't, if it's not easy to get there, then who is being allowed in there and what are they showing us from inside?
Absolutely. You know, it's the big question, so in terms of if you're not allowed in, why not? What are they hiding? What have they actually got to sort of, you know, keep to one side and so on? So again, is there a solution? I mean, what would you do, George?
I think if you go towards the other side of like, oh yeah, everyone can come in with their iPhones, then you've just got like,
anarchy.
Kind of promoting, is it like channelism, the phrase as well, whereas you're just like constantly chucking out loads of stuff and but I suppose that would kind of be a good thing. Obviously, in an ideal world, you just want like one or two really good news media companies that you could trust, but then if you look at like the BBC, aren't they like partly funded by the government? Don't really
points, licence fee payer who sort of funds the BBC. The government have actually set the level of the fee, so that's the point. I mean, it kind of is one of those challenging questions to ask, because if you look at, say, Signet, for instance, if you're dealing with a client for Signet who wants to actually attend every single Signet meeting, whether or not their topic are being discussed, do you say no? Do you have a right to say no? Do you say, where do you actually sort of develop that whole process? Again, and again, as you said, George, maybe having some kind of notion of knowing who you're working with is appropriate, but at the same time, you need to have a set process by which you know how people can apply, and also perhaps a reason, a rationale for why they're turned down. It's an interesting sort of line, but again, it's in that whole area, which is why I come back to the I word, indeterminacy. There isn't necessarily sort of a right answer or wrong answer for this. The press, of course, being the fourth estate, that's a statement that came out from a former Guardian political reporter, Malcolm Dean, who's effectively saying in that system that because citizen journalism, social media, the web, have your say sites, people effectively taking their own particular take on things, and, as you said, journalism, which is pushing stuff out there, actually we have less content, in other words, less substance and a lot of style. It's all about the surface gloss. And there might well be, in fact, actually, it's not, there may well be, I think there will be people whose sole appreciation of political decisions are made quite simply from watching things, as we saw at the start of this particular module, with respect to the Dominic Raab dramatisation and Benedict Cumberbatch's Brexit sort of aspect. Now, you might say, well, that tells you an awful lot about things, which may all be true, but it's also done from one particular viewpoint. If I was being brutally honest, I'd say, well, we didn't really, in that particular dramatisation, see a positive side of Farage or Johnson or whoever. Interesting enough, I mean, Boris, I saw you to somebody else who also knows him very well the other day and were featuring on, apparently. He has shamed the old Etonians. As an Etonian, they are the Etonians, or the Eton group, which is kind of like the wonderful Eton public school sort of sector. they are ashamed, quote unquote, of Boris. Say anything as long as he can be Prime Minister. No! But, nevertheless, you're still talking about how do you actually do it. And the key word there is well informed. You know, information is power, knowledge is power. The more you actually know about things, the more you can actually challenge, then the easier it actually becomes to hopefully start beginning to raise your issues and so on. The very colourful last sentence there, less grit in the democratic oyster means fewer policy pearls. You know, an oyster produces pearls because sand gets into it and it irritates it and effectively sort of rolls it up and you get this wonderful pearl that's produced as a result of that. So maybe you need that equivalent of roughage to actually ask the questions. And maybe when you're doing your own analysis of your campaigns, one of the things to think about is how does this actually raise issues from both sides, you know, and look at the sort of aspects that are coming through in terms of how those things are there, whether it's gender issues in sport or legalising cannabis in the United States, either of those things, you know, what are those sort of lines? Was it Canada? It was Canada, wasn't it? Yeah, because obviously then you need to build a wall, and you did all sorts of things would be there. Wonderful phrase I came across recently, which I thought was really pertinent to the sort of Donald Trump thing, that actually there are two kinds of human beings. Bridge builders and wall builders. If you're a bridge builder, you're looking to make connections between different people, different connections. If you're building a wall, if you're a wall builder, you want to separate out people specifically into different divisions. Which one are you? I'm not going to ask people, but just rhetorically, do you see yourself as a bridge builder? Do you see yourself as a wall builder? Interesting kind of metaphor, which I thought was really positive, actually. Actually, I think it might have been Pope Francis. Yeah. Anyway, lots of challenges in the Catholic Church as well, but that's a different line. Okay, how do we actually see this continuing to develop, etc.? Again, I've talked to it, just cited a couple of examples here, Hilgartner and Bosk and Blum. But we do see things that develop in the public sphere. We do see that social problems don't simply emerge. People have actually addressed them. You know, it's not a case of we have issues relating to the gender pay gap, issues relating to name your particular sort of topic, etc. It can't always needs to reach critical mass before you actually begin to get some sort of definition that either something is fundamentally wrong, it's challenging, and so on. And also social arena very much to the fore of homelessness. I know Christine's doing an aspect of homelessness. I think a couple of people doing homelessness as one of the options. Is that somebody else who's doing homelessness? Oh. FIFA Fair Play, any of those sort of aspects. But again, if you're looking at that whole aspect of specialists, if you have fewer specialists to actually understand the issues, does that mean that wonderful Habermasian concept in which you have people sharing their opinions and coming up with a solution as a result of that shared viewpoint, is that becoming more and more difficult to actually develop? Even though in theory, with all the social media, it should be a lot easier. So, there's a biological term, which effectively stands for two or more items working to the benefit of both. So if something's in a symbiotic relationship, both sides will benefit. The opposite of symbiosis is parasitism, where effectively one person is, or one form is a parasite and just takes from another organisational line from that. Yes, as Davis says, the professional economic objectives of journalists are often different from public interest, because journalists are in the business, of selling newspapers, getting more people watching their TV shows, reading their blogs, listening to their radio programs, and so on, obviously. Can they actually work with politicians who want to feed into that? The Today program on Radio 4, very popular with politicians because it sets the agenda. It doesn't have a massive audience, but it sets the agenda. It's an influencer. Key word that's used an awful lot for vloggers and social media people. You're putting your views online to be shot down or not, but you become an influencer. whether you're talking about social justice warriors in Doctor Who, or whether you're talking about the latest brand of perfume to actually sort of use and develop, or animal rights and so on. Any of those key things, you know, in theory, there is a view that the more you actually attract, the bigger your influence, the bigger your sphere of influence. But does that also mean that you're looking at, sometimes you want to get the right kind of people that you're influencing? Would it be better to have 3 million hits on your particular website, or maybe just 3,000 key politicians and political leaders from across the globe who actually turn to your own views as the essential things they should be following? Again, it's open to debate, but it's that whole notion of who's influencing what. And also, you know, Mein Kampf, Mein Struggle, written by, of course, Adolf Hitler, his struggle for success and various other bits and pieces, they can be harmful as much as beneficial. You've got to sort of bear in mind what's being said. Scroll forward to the whole Brexit debate, etc. You know, the fallout from that, conceivably, will be pretty much, and that, well, who knows, maybe global warming will take over. But together with issues like that, the kind of scene setter, certainly for the next 10, 15, 20 years or so. Probably longer. So it comes back to that whole line when we're talking about political communications. And again, the sort of aspect where you could say that from a public relations point of view, it's almost a no-win situation. Do you make the policies in secret and then release them? Or do you actually have it openly discussed in terms of saying, you know, we want to, should we have a second referendum? Do we say, no, we can't do that? Was having a referendum in the first place the worst decision to actually be made? How do we define better decisions? You know, history is always, you know, looking at hindsight always gives you 20/20 vision. You know, history, well, you know, we look back and say, of course, why didn't we do this, etc. You know, we've looked at this session over the last few weeks at some of the issues that Tony Blair had with respect to Iraq and the weapons of mass destruction and the images that sort of were put forward with respect to that. We can kind of say now, well, of course it was wrong. Would we have been that confident at the time to sort of say that was wrong? Oh, again, is that a case of conviction politics? We can open up and discuss and address a whole range of other sort of factors. So let's, again, just consider some of the things which are branding now as the new specialists, which could, as I say, encompass social media and other areas as well that we talked about. Well, there are just literally a selection, to be precise, I think 10, 11, of some of the main political blogs that are actually there. Interestingly, mostly using pseudonyms or anonymous lines. We know sometimes how things are actually developed from that point of view, but equally political blogs can give you a sort of insight in terms of what people are actually thinking. And again, it's worthwhile when you're doing your analysis and critique, looking not only at some of the political blogs that surround the kind of issues you're talking about, as well as obviously the populist things, the populist media and the mass media coverage of the topics that you're looking at from that point of view. For the same reason that I've just been saying in terms of the line of influencers and who is being influenced. And is that a conceit as well to think that, you know, people are so naive that they'll read something and say, well, it must be true. I mean, I read it on BuzzFeed. It's essential. You know, it's got to be true. I don't know, maybe there are people who actually sort of take BuzzFeed as their source of absolute gospel truth. If it ain't on BuzzFeed, it's not true. Top 10 tips for coping with whatever. Some of the examples there, of course, there's the man himself. He's got an example of sort of the logs. And just look at the sort of the titles that you've actually got there. Winners and how they will succeed. Avail or to put you. Clearly, you know, has he done this because he wants to feel as though, yeah, that shares? No, you know, nice to obviously buy a copy of the book. Alistair Campbell knows all about winning. As Tony Blair's chief spokesman and strategist, he helped guide the Labour Party to victory in 3 successive general elections. And he's fascinated by what it takes to win. How do sportsmen excel, entrepreneurs thrive, or individuals achieve their ambition? Is their ability to win innate, or is the winning gene something we can all develop? Well, the very fact that you're doing public relations at the University of Lincoln means that you already are a winner. Yay! So there's no worries there whatsoever. Don't think he mentions that in the book there. Outrageous. You should write a sequel. Put it together with a blog. Look at how things are being developed. publishing is becoming more and more, certainly in terms of not just fictional writers, but also writers of things where you need to develop that blog. You put the ideas out there. Now, you might get, you know, 4 or 5 people, 50,000, 50 million, etc. But again, it's looking at sort of comments that are actually being made, and it's really reflecting on that. In the same way, as Habermas would say, this is your social sphere. You talk about the high-stress psychological work that politics takes part in. Let's discuss it. Let's talk through various other bits and pieces as well. It's a way of kind of opening up bits and pieces as well. And of course, you know, clearly if you've got that celebrity edge as well and you're putting things forward, you can have the personalisation of the autograph, the sign there, charity, always important, media, public speaking, books, etc., etc., etc. Communicator, writer, strategist. Actually, everybody in this room is a communicator, writer, and strategist. So, you know, think about putting it together in terms of your CVs and various other sort of aspects. So now a slightly brighter one in terms of lines that we actually get there from that perspective. And again, same sort of aspects of the conservative home, the home of conservatism, you know, nice red, white and blue-ish colours, or slightly pink actually in many ways. Toby Fenwick, a nuclear option that funds the armed forces. Charlotte Leslie MP, why young people should have a vote at 16. You know, these are things which might be picked up on by the mainstream media, but your key target audience for the conservative home are people who are already part of the Conservative Party, likewise Labour, likewise various other bits and pieces. Does that mean, again, you're simply preaching to the converted? So you're getting an echo chamber that actually views that are being expressed here, such as the case for Trident, you know, you're not necessarily going to be a rampant nuclear abolitionist from that point of view. You will see how things will actually work through that process, etc. Or is it deliberately put out to provoke and antagonise? Probably not. But again, you're never sure in terms of where stories and things get taken from and so on. Same thing, as I say. You know, balance, obviously, conservative, Labourist, Labour's plan for prosperity, better business, not just big business. You know, the argument recently with respect to anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, is it something which has been blown about of all proportion by the media, the establishment, since we were last actually sitting around, really, where you've got a new centrist party of people who don't quite know what they stand for, but they just don't like politics as it is, so they just sort of resigned and become independents, and they just sort of do that. Who knows? You know, there are all ways in which you're kind of raising those issues about what's taking place and so on, and how can you actually get involved with the system as well. And likewise, you know, in terms of Ian Daler, radio presenter of the year, actually this is about 2 years ago from that point of view, LBC Drive Time presenter, his attitude, what's wrong with a bit of gratuitous nudity? Anybody intend to be presenting in the news? Just let me know. So. Oh, Zach, I thought you were going to do it just with a fig leaf. No, okay, sorry, that's fine. Okay, same sort of thing. You know, you lead with a title which is catchy, which might be a little bit controversial, that raises the whole thing, and then you go into your discussion and lines from that perspective as well. Okay, so what are the challenges with respect to that new list of people who are involved? Well, it's been said before, it'll be said again, these are not fully trained journalists who are writing this stuff. In most cases, not all, but in a lot of cases, these are folks who have not necessarily learned about the importance of checking the sources, learned about the importance of balance, impartiality, and the right way to write press releases and so on. They might have picked it up, but they're basically people who could be, they could be, again, people who've had lots of experience in industry and in politics, or they might literally be, you know, the bloke next door who's currently actually sort of, you know, clearing his sewers out and is therefore infecting Jennifer with all sorts of things, including probably, I don't know, you could go down with, well, the plague, presumably. You know, if it's untreated sewage, you know, you could be all sorts of things. Exactly. Bloggers are not accountable. I mean, there is a talk, there's the debate that's going on with respect to Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, that the government are again talking about making these just as legally accountable as publishers already are, in terms of you can't publish stuff on there which is not checked out, is validated and so on. But actually, one of the things about the web, which some might say, understandably, is one of the joys of the web, is actually it doesn't really matter if it's not a view that's common, even if it's the Flat Earth Society or any of the particular views that are actually there. It's something that needs to be added. It's democracy. It's airing that plurality of views. Yeah, there are material that actually that's out there. However, it's often seen that people like to take on board a kind of false importance, a false sense of their own importance and so on. And so the perception that you actually get is that, yes, they're right, it is all the fault of the Polish immigrants who are taking all of our jobs picking apples in Boston. It's really creating problems. Because you kind of, you know, you're sort of drawn into that system from that point of view. And the most dangerous, of course, as indeed Lenin and Stalin once said, is if you want to tell a lie, just give it a couple of truths around it and then repeat it often enough. A couple of truths and a lie. So you have a mixture of opinion and, air quotes, fact. You know, it's how true is it? How do we talk about this? It's great that anybody can do it, but do they have other agendas that they're pushing? What is their agenda? What is their view from that point of view? But if it's encouraging people to talk about things, then that surely has to be a good thing, unless it switches people off. And we can't be bothered because there's so much information out there, we just can't cope. We are bears of little brain, as Winnie the Pooh would say. Next week, I promise I shall bring in my new friend, Hammy the Hamster. It's all right, he's an artificial life form. But he's great. I've already had hours of fun since he arrived through the post a few days ago. You say things, he says it back, he says, that's my name. Hopefully encourage some debate from that point of view. Treat for next week. Held it back for this week because that would be too much. And besides, you know, Christine is a whole new event, so we'll work through that. Okay. Coleman writing there in terms of a thing called the politics of listening. Blogs provide a channel for authentic expression that is free from the repressive controls of traditional media. Now, that presupposes two or three key things. One, that traditional media is repressive, that we live in a totalitarian state where effectively, rather like Pravda in the old Soviet Union, there's only one size and one truth, and that's the only thing that's ever published. Or, it also suggests that, well, maybe, you know, it is democracy in action. It opens up a whole range of different aspects. And for listening, you can use that as a synonym for reading, for finding out information and so on. It's the sort of thing which in a few moments' time, when we have a few presentations, you know, you'll be looking at what views are being put forward and so on and so forth. A couple of key things to sort of begin to conclude with there. Patrick Moynihan, a relatively well-known American senator. Interesting line, you're entitled to your own opinions, but not to your own facts. Everybody has an opinion. Ask 1,000 people in Lincoln for their opinion on one particular aspect and you get 1,000 different answers. Well, you might get, you know, some of the same answers and so on. You might put a questionnaire, you might do various other bits and pieces. But it's one of the reasons why, actually, when we talk about questionnaires, when we talk about a public relations practice of building stories around information and research, they'll usually be looking at a minimum of 500 to 1,000 to sometimes 2,000 people who've been asked specific things online. It's something to bear in mind when you go on to your dissertations in terms of the methodology that you choose to apply. A lot of people say, I'm going to do a questionnaire. And then we sort of point out that actually absolute bare minimum to get some decent responses is probably 50. Ideally, you look at minimum 500. Because otherwise you can't really translate what might be a generalised sort of thought into, well, it's just a few random sort of aspects on that basis. Now, do bloggers actually take that line? Do they actually go and ask 50, 5,000, 1,000, 100? How many people do they actually ask? Or do they just go for their gut feeling? I mean, it may be perfectly fine to go through gut feeling, but it may not necessarily have the kind of truthfulness that it actually requires to become something which we would be worthwhile listening to. there's an example there in terms of the sort of system. Nobody's heard of John Edwards, I would have thought, but he was Basically, the claim was that he was withdrawing from the presidential race, which eventually went to Barack Obama, of course. I just bought his wife with breast cancer. That was taken from just one blog source, which was wrong. And the blogger was actually a trained White House School of Journalism, or Washington School of Journalism journalist. He put it out there as an example of fake news. Fake news has always been around from that point of view. But the fact was, that wasn't the reason why Edwards withdrew at all. But it was the reason that was put up as the line in terms of why he was stepping away from the process. And that, again, is one of the reasons why, when you're talking about that public sphere, Davis is, you know, again, this was a discussion paper put forward in the Harvard sort of area, you simply get a reaction. You don't get a considered response. However, if it's good for democracy, maybe that's perfectly acceptable. So, a little line there. Does anybody agree with that whole side of things? Blogging requires passion and authority, which leaves out most people. You're nodding, George. Why are you nodding?
I think that some people just don't care about things enough to blog.
Absolutely.
And that life is that quite nicely.
Yeah.
People are quite happy consuming.
Precisely. Staggering backwards into the future, looking longingly at the past, and saying, oh, back in my day, etc. You're right. And at all levels of society, becoming engaged with the process, you know, actually becoming engaged with the public sphere, does involve a certain amount of proactivity. You know, it's just, you know, like coming along to a lecture, coming along to a seminar, involves a certain amount of proactivity. Otherwise, you're not going to get the benefits. It's the old classic line of, you get out of something, what do you put into something? Which fundamentally, again, has its roots in things from this perspective. Which brings us neatly round, with 46 minutes clocked out, to the next thing I wanted to actually talk about. Oh, that's not that one. Which roles and responsibilities. Yeah, we've kind of sort of adjusted this around slightly, because obviously last week we looked at the functions of the political journalist, so I kind of crossed that over slightly to this week in terms of the specialist reporters. But if we're looking at roles and responsibilities of specialist reporters, from the sort of session and lecture that I've actually just given, things to take away, bear in mind you need to know your sources, you need to effectively ensure that things are checked, that facts are checked and developed, and also that there's an awful lot of disagreement between what is actually happening, what is perceived as happening, and what people who are actually taking part in the whole thing think is actually happening, as indeed the discussions with Alistair Campbell actually showed from that point of view.